Prologue. Slowly, cautiously, Robert, along with the other creatures that slither, crawl, and kill in the night, crept toward the cottage. Frogs, crickets, and others to be eaten raised a chorus of protest as loud as in a rainforest. Go back. Go back. Go back. At the door, he rehearsed the mnemonic she had taught him. Cross my heart and hope to die. It played in his mind to the tune of Mary Had a Little Lamb. Cross my heart and hope to die. Hope to die. Hope to. The door clicked and opened. The house was cold as stone. He remembered the way to the kitchen. Use the one you used this summer, she had told him. It was too dark for him to see into the drawer. He fumbled around, the contents clanging like off-key church bells summoning the living to follow the dead. Then he pulled one out. He climbed the stairs to the bedroom. The figures were sleeping, covered with a white comforter. He went to them and raised the knife. Then Robert paused. She had directed everything, what to wear, how to get to the cottage, how to disarm the alarm, even what knife to use. But she had not told him about this. She had not told him how to kill someone with a knife. Chapter 1. A Foolish Life. 1 year earlier. Youth, where did it go? During his childhood, he had tried to give it away. After he succeeded, he couldn't get it back. He was 25, alive, and had lived a foolish life. He was introspective enough to see the foolishness of someone who was only 25, thinking they had already lived a foolish life. But today, that wasn't a foolish thought. It was a final thought. A late summer cold front had come through the Chicago area, and with it, rain, which temporarily cooled off the region. He put on his jacket to protect against the cold and the rain and went out to sit in the gazebo. He brought three things with him: his phone, a bottle of scotch, and a gun. The phone was always with him. The scotch, to help him through this cold, rainy day. And the gun, well, the gun was for today as well. Rain drummed on the roof and the patio, saturating the surrounding grounds. A musty smell of earthworms rose from the earth and filled his nostrils. Occasionally a breeze blew mist onto his face, and he huddled deeper into his jacket. Rain and fog all but hid his view of Lake Michigan. The mansion, which he had never been in, was nearly invisible. The carriage house, where he did live, was hidden behind him. The weather closed in, and his world became small. He started drinking the scotch. He was a college graduate, an artist, and a photographer, and today he was going to kill himself. He had started off searching for the soul of America, somewhere between Wichita and the Bighorn Mountains. He ended up in Chicago. He was going to capture that soul in his photographs and paintings. Instead, he was producing images for a porn dealer. He preferred calling it exotic artwork. The artwork was displayed in Gallo's Galleria. Galleria. He snorted. In this case, a polite name for porn shop. At first, the dealer had him do pictures of pretty, young, naked girls. He thought that a cosmic joke. I'm a disaster around girls. He invented a set of rules when working with the models. A shield he could hide behind. The internet is full of free pictures of pretty, young, naked girls. There weren't many sales of his artwork. He needed to earn a living, so the dealer gave him erotic stories to illustrate. He had wanted to capture men's souls. Now his art was grabbing their cocks. This wasn't the life he dreamed of when he was a little boy, when he imagined the glorious adventure his life was to be. His mother would take him out at night, and he would sit on her lap in a rocking chair. The two would look up at the stars. His mother pointed out the Big and Little Dippers and how to find the North Star. Find that, she told him, and you will always know where you are. You could be an astronomer. That was a big word. He couldn't pronounce it. He asked her if he could drink from the Milky Way. She laughed and hugged him to her chest, and the two looked up and danced among the stars. His father did not dance. Ariana? Ariana? Oh yes. Once upon a time there had been Ariana in his life. He left her when he had set off on his soul search. Did she try to find me? Did she look for me? He called her in the year after he left. Her phone had been disconnected. Click. He called a friend of hers. She quit school and left soon after you did. And screw you if you think I'll tell you anything more. Click. He called her parents' house. They lived in Chicago. Click. Even in his alcohol-muddled mind, he could see more clearly now than he did then that she had loved him. The young think if something comes easily, it will come again. Love had found him when he wasn't looking, but he left it to chase the wild wind across the American Great Plains. Love was not going to find him again. He was living on the estate of a wealthy family, north of the city, where the high-rises end and houses begin. He had moved in early in the summer when the family was on vacation. They were at a place their agent called the cottage. He never met them. All communication was through the agent. He was told that only the owner, Sam Gallo, his wife, Elaine, and their daughter lived on the estate. The agent didn't remember the daughter's name. He thought she was about 20. The owner of the estate was the selfsame owner of where he worked, Gallo's Galleria. Still, he was told the owner liked to support the arts, and from time to time, made the carriage house available to a promising artist where the artist lived for a while, developing and creating, all expenses paid. He was told he was being given this opportunity because he was considered somewhat up and coming. He had even been featured in one of the city's small arts magazines. He did not feel up and coming. What he did feel was his life leaving him, oozing from his entrails, up his chest, down his arm, trickling through his fingers and out the brush like the paint that dripped onto his easel. When he was young, his canvas was blank and white, waiting for him to paint on it with all the colors of the rainbow. But he had done it wrong and smeared his canvas with the same gray that he was sitting in now. To say he was going to kill himself in first purpose. That is not entirely accurate. His life had no purpose, nor did today. He would stumble into his death with the same bumbling, blundering, and fumbling he lived life. His soul search had bogged down in the back room of a porn shop. He had neither the inclination nor wherewithal to do differently. To move forward seemed too hard, and going back, futile. Go back to what? His mother gone, his father dead, and Ariana, yes, she was gone too. The phone was always with him. The scotch, often enough, but the gun was unfamiliar. It had been his father's. Unlike the phone, and even the scotch, he kept it hidden in a drawer under his socks and the photograph. He tried to pull back the gun slide. His fingers, wet from the mist the wind blew at him, slipped. He startled when the slide clanged against the barrel. He tried again, holding tighter this time, and saw the cartridge load into the chamber. He held on tight and let the slide back slowly. He did not know if the gun would go off if he just let go. He didn't want it to go off by mistake. That would be really dumb, accidentally killing myself. Throughout the cold afternoon, he took turns drinking the scotch and handling the gun, sometimes placing it to his head, once even putting the muzzle in his mouth, tasting metal and oil that several drinks of scotch were needed to take away. Looking at the muzzle. Such a small hole, really. Could so much damage come out of it? So much blood. It should be easy. He would be hard to miss. Put gun in mouth, pull trigger. Had it been this way for his father? The only sin from which one cannot repent. It scared him he had come to this. Who made you? God made me. Why did God make you? He was bored? No. For his glory. Well, there was no glory in this. What would Sister Anya say? Thou shall not kill. Oh, shit. That was supposed to be the easy one. Let's see, what were those? Now you're boring. No. This is important. I need to think this through. Come on, get on with the killing. This won't take long, there's only 10. The first 5 are about God. No problem, God's in his heaven, and all's right with the world. Next. There's the one about honoring your mother and father, so they may have a long life. Irrelevant. Your father's dead, and who cares about your mother? Not you. Go on. You shall not commit adultery. He paused. Let me get back to you on that. You shall not steal. He prided himself on that one, never have, never will. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. Time's a wasting. Almost done. Don't covet your neighbor's stuff. I'm good with that. I'm an artist. I'm supposed to be poor and starving. He took a drink of his scotch and looked out over the patio and the pool. He smiled. If you're going to kill yourself, why not in a mansion rather than a shack? He had tried shack, mansion was better. So get on with it. What about the killing? Thou shall not kill. It said. Well, it can't mean that. God has people kill other people. God kills all kinds of people all the time. But to kill oneself, does that count? What do you think? He had his fingers crossed. It counts. Killing is killing. Soldiers at war, capital punishment, self-defense. Yep. All killing. You will go to hell if you break a commandment, sister warned. What if it's just a matter of interpretation? What if it read, thou shall not murder, instead of thou shall not kill? Now that could be a different thing. That might work. Murder sounds like there's some assent, some purpose, some evil intent. That's not in you. Is it? No. That wasn't him. He was just weary of life. So let's go with murder. Murder is definitely the better way to go. Thou shall not murder. You can't murder yourself. You can only kill yourself. Okay. I can live with. Time's up. He was an observer of life, not a doer in life. Even now, he was watching from about 3 feet to his left and 2 feet above his head. So, this is what it's like to commit suicide. It's now or never. He used to think his life should have some reason. It wasn't supposed to end like this. There's no time like the present. But in a moment, it would. Do it. Do it. Do it. He reached for the gun. Now. A car door slammed. Then, voices. He put the gun in his pocket, picked up the phone and the scotch, and went back to the carriage house. The family had returned. Chapter 2. I'll call you Robert. Scene 1. The two girls in his life. He was in the carriage house the next morning, sitting at a table that looked out onto the patio and the pool area, staring at the gazebo where yesterday he had sat with the gun to his head. It was a place he now and would forevermore call, my spot. The cold front had passed, the storm clouds were clearing, and the hot Midwestern summer returned, now even muggier because of the recent rain. Carriage house, is what the agent said the owner's wife called it, hadn't been used for horses for the last 100 years. A stable is what the original owners thought they had built. There were two sections. The front was a large space with token, functional furniture. The agent told him its primary use was for party spillovers from the pool area and accommodating a sleepover partier who had too much to drink. On one side stood a bar that also provided the essentials of a kitchen. On the other side were a bathroom and a room with a bed and a small closet. Occasionally an artist was allowed to live here, that would be him for now. The second part of the carriage house was a room in the back, as large as the front, but unlike the front, was full of an eclectic collection of chairs, couches, boxes, mirrors, lamps, tables, and numerous paintings and pieces of art. He could see it had been used as a studio, for there was lighting, an easel next to a small table to hold paints and art supplies, and another, large table, on which a model could sit or lay and pose. When he moved in, he brought nothing to add to the place, no furniture, no knickknacks, decorations, and, except for the gun and the photograph, no mementos. Two suitcases of clothing, his camera equipment, and a used Jeep were all he possessed. When he looked about the place, there was nothing of him in it. When he would ultimately leave, there would be nothing of him left to show that he had ever been here. He hadn't committed suicide. He wondered if he even wanted to. He played yesterday over in his mind, and the voice taunting and goading him. That voice had been with him during his childhood, sitting inside the top of his head, criticizing him when he would make a mistake. Idiot. Chiding him for his dreams. Fool. It was with him when he had found his father. Guilty. If the family returning hadn't interrupted him, Would he have finished it? In that last second, would he have pulled the trigger? He could have ended his misery by ending his life. Did he want to live? He thought about that. The voice was mute. Live? He didn't know. But die? No. He didn't want to die. He couldn't kill himself. Then he became more depressed because now he realized his misery could never end. The extent of that thought slipped over him and smothered him like a second skin. He was grieving? Why? His father? Perhaps, but that was 2 years ago. That should be enough time for grieving. His mother? No. He was over her. Yes. He certainly was. He cried when she left, terribly. He had vowed that would never happen again. Ariana? Sweet, pure, chaste, well no longer chaste thanks to him, Ariana. If ever he had sinned, it's what he did to her. He remembered her first words to him, "You look lost." Yes, he was. Hi. You look lost. It was the start of his fourth year at the college. In his first years, he focused on science classes and rarely went to the fine arts building. Now he was taking a drawing class and only had a vague idea of the location of his classroom. "I'm in that class too," she said. "Come on, I'll walk with you." Her name was Ariana. They sat next to each other, their only class together that semester. He was studying visual arts. Ariana was more performing arts. He was not into that. He lectured her. "Dance, acting art forms are not permanent, unlike painting and sculpture. Someone rehearses hard for a dance recital, performs it, and it's over. Even a play is over after each performance, and certainly after the final curtain. But a painting? A painting lives on even after the artist is gone. A written song is permanent, but the playing of that music is over with the last note." They spent the next days discussing what else they were not into, what they were into, their interests, their not interests, likes, dislikes. Ariana wanted to be a dancer. He wasn't sure what he wanted, only sure that whatever he did had to be great. Who they knew, why so-and-so acted that way, why the world was the way it was, how it could be, should be, would be better, what each wanted to do during their lifetime in it, and all that was wrong with pineapple on pizza were topics they pondered and probed. Whispering during class, hurrying between classes, lunch together, strolling to her dorm, they found whatever time they could to be with each other. She was from Chicago. He thought that made her sophisticated. Still, it was cute she blushed during the drawing the male nude part of the class. "Would you like to go see a movie?" She would. They became a couple and climbed the first few steps of intimacy. He held her hand during the movie and even put his arm around her shoulder when he walked her back to her dorm. Through the following days, that arm massaged her back while the couple walked about and pulled her waist or hip playfully to him whenever she would say something silly. And Ariana was sure to frequently say something silly. The first kiss, that took a little while. Their dates always ended with their saying goodnight at the steps of her dorm, where other couples were busy making out. He left her there several nights without the kiss and kicked himself each time. She wanted to be kissed, didn't she? Get some nerve, pal. Then there was that night they stood with their arms around the other. Everything there was to talk about said. "Well, good night." "Night." "I probably better get going."
"K. Night."
"Night." He moved his head toward her. She closed her eyes, their lips touched, and then there was no more talking. Kissing now took place pretty much anytime they were together, serious kissing when they were alone. Ariana held his face while their tongues explored each other's mouths. He must untangled her long hair during their sessions, and she would need to comb it out when she got back to her room. He had mentioned how he liked her legs and how smooth they were. So, even as the days grew shorter and the evenings colder, she wore skirts and shorts for him. Their favorite spot was on the bandstand in the park by Ariana's dorm. Sometimes other couples used this place, but as it got colder, he and Ariana were usually alone. Here he explored the limits of their intimacy. His hand ran up and down on the outside of her legs at will, but on the inside, when it climbed too far, Ariana would press her legs together to signal, far enough. And a gentle, firm hand from her stopped his whenever it tried to get inside her blouse. There was a flash of light as the patio door of the mansion opened and caught the sunlight. For the 2 months he lived in the carriage house, he had never seen that door open. Then she came out. Later in life, he would reflect, and she walked into my life. Then he would smile. Did that sound too much like Humphrey Bogart? He guessed she was the owner's daughter. The agent had told him she was about 20, he hadn't mentioned she could stop his heart. She had a long, slim body and blonde hair, her breasts thrust against her bikini top, and her bikini bottom clung on her swaying hips. She was barefoot. He saw the muscles in her legs and calves flex as she walked. Her breasts were small, like a girl's. He liked that. The models he photographed for the porn were all large-breasted, give the customer what they want. He couldn't make out the color of her eyes at this distance. He thought blue. She moved with the grace of a dancer to my spot and tossed a towel on it. Then she stretched and pulled at her suit and did those other things a girl does when she thinks she is not being watched. He felt dizzy, his head larger, then he took a breath. She spread out the towel, put on some lotion, and laid down. He stepped away from the window while he examined her so she wouldn't be able to see him. He studied her, assessing her as he did with the models during a photo shoot. There they knew they were on stage, to be posed, evaluated, and critiqued. That's what they were paid for, after all. When people are face to face, one or the other will occasionally avert their eyes, turn the head, not stare too long at the other. It isn't polite. But this girl was unaware of the intensity with which his eyes were probing her, and there was nothing polite about it. He coolly photographed nude models nearly every day without even the hint of an erection. Perhaps the fact that this was improper, his observing her without her knowing, intimate with her on his terms, maybe the secrecy of it that aroused him. She was a distance from him. He wanted to see her closer, so he got his camera and telephoto lens from the back room and pointed it at her. He adjusted the zoom to bring her in. There, that was better. He filled his camera's frame with her face, her breasts, her legs, her bare feet. It was just second nature that he started clicking the shutter. Occasionally she got up and stretched a bit or paraded around swinging her arms. Once, she had skipped over to the pool and threw water on her face. He caught her as she turned around, laughing. It was almost like he was next to her. After she left, he brought his computer to the table and loaded the photos into it. A good half were unusable. He had not held the camera still enough for the extreme telephoto close-up shots. Some were blurred, and some the gazebo or a chair blocked her when she had changed positions. Most were because he had been so damn nervous. He deleted these. He devoted the rest of the day to studying the remaining photos. She was not perfect, he decided. Her left eye was a little narrower than her right. The right side of her lip curved up slightly, so it looked like she was thinking of some secret joke. When she pulled her hair back, he noticed her ear stuck out. Deformities, he thought, that if a little more pronounced would make her ugly. As they were, they made her beautiful. Her legs were perfect. He saw her eyes were blue. He picked the best 20 photos and transferred these to a separate folder in his computer. That night he went to bed and held the computer on his knee so he could see the screen. He opened the 20 favorites folder, set it to view as a slideshow, and masturbated. He spent the next morning with his computer, scrolling through the folders that held the several thousand photographs he had, many of which he had taken himself at the studio and the porn shop. So many girls, in various stages of undress, in various interesting poses, doing so many provocative things. He had access to gigabytes more photos with his link to the computer at the shop. The folder with the 20 he spent last night with was the one he kept going back to. His favorite was of the girl after tossing water in her face. It was a wonderful picture, the best of them all. Funny he found it so appealing. It didn't show any of her except her face. She wore no makeup, water dripped off her nose, wet strands of hair caught across her face and half-closed eyes. It revealed the innocence of a girl laughing at her silliness and the beauty of a woman who could still do that. It was charming and seductive, innocent and sensual, and he fell in love with it. He made it the background on his computer so it would always be available to him. All the photos, including his favorite, were slightly blurred. He had held his camera as steady as he could, but at a high telephoto close-up, some jiggle was unavoidable. He got his tripod, secured the camera to it, set it on the table next to the window, and waited for her. He waited the entire day. She never came out, nor the next. But the next day, she did, following the same ritual as the first day. He watched her lying there and took pictures, watched her breathing, and took pictures, watched as she stretched and moved, and took pictures. The next day she also came out. He was waiting. He followed her through his camera, observing her close up. He had a lot of photos of her by now, but those were frozen and lifeless. He wanted to follow her as she moved. Watch her skin glistening with the sun and lotion, her breasts moving up and down as she breathed in, then out, then in. He breathed with her. He could make out the tiny blonde hairs on her chest, the peach fuzz that covered her body, and imagine skimming his fingers over them, giving her goosebumps, causing her to giggle, teasing her, arousing her. Up, down, she breathed. He tried to discern the beating of her heart. Her breasts pressed against the fabric of her bathing suit. Her nipples poked at the material. Why didn't she sunbathe topless? Nobody was around. He took off her top, and his eyes roamed over the mounds of her breasts. His tongue circled her nipples, kissing them, sucking them in, out, making them hard. He turned the camera back to her face. Shit. She was staring at him. She stood up and walked toward the carriage house. His leg hit the table, causing it to scrape on the hard floor and the camera and tripod to fall over. His face froze. His heart skittered. He ducked down and peered over the windowsill. Shit. 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 Caught. No, I wasn't. Really, you must be mistaken. Shit. 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 Oh damn. She strode in without knocking. There was no time to hide the camera. Hi, my name's Kelly. He sucked in his breath and could only blurt, Bob Duran. She strolled up to him, her skin tan and glistening, the heat of summer washing up behind her. Bob. No, I think I'll call you Robert. Kelly handed him the pink jar with the lotion she used when she was sunbathing. Here, Robert, help me out, put some lotion on my back. It's a special one I have made for me. It's a sunblock, a moisturizer, it doesn't absorb into the skin, so it stays slippery, and it smells good too. Is it good for arthritis? Robert asked. Kelly tilted her head and looked at him. I don't have arthritis. Why would you ask that? Oh, no reason. Just kidding. Do you always make fun of what people are saying? No, sorry, maybe when I'm nervous. Oh, so do I make you nervous? Yeah, a little. Amazed and dazzled were two other words Robert thought of, but to his credit, did not say. Kelly grinned and placed one hand on her chest to hold her bikini top and reached behind her with the other and pulled at the straps. Then she turned, exposing her bare back to him. Kelly's skin was warm. She smelled like the summer sun. Robert parted her hair and put the lotion on her neck. Then he worked his way down her shoulders and back. Her bikini bottom did not cover much. Robert hesitated. Do all of me. I don't want to get burned. Robert flushed and finished spreading the lotion. Thanks. Would you tie me up? Do what? What are you thinking? Tie my top back up, silly. Robert did, then Kelly bounced around. Where's your phone? Before he could answer, Kelly was halfway across the room. Oh, I see it on the table. Robert panicked. The prostrate camera and tripod were there too. Kelly picked up the phone. Here's my number. Maybe you can call me sometime, and I'll return the favor. She headed toward the door, then turned. Robert, it's okay if you take pictures of me. Robert's face turned feverish, his ears burned, he stammered. I didn't. Robert, don't lie to me. No, I didn't. I hate liars. Always tell me the truth. Okay? Okay. Promise? Yes. Do you promise to always tell me the truth?
Yes.
Robert, you can take pictures of me. Okay?
Kelly, I.
Robert?
Okay.
Scene 2. Phone sex. For the rest of the day, Kelly filled Robert's head, right to the brim. He tried to do other things to get his mind off her, but he kept sneaking back to his computer and its images of her. She was his angel, his temptress. He wanted to inhale her in and devour her. Own her, and surrender to her. Ravish her, then love her. That night he got ready for bed. He took off his clothes and underwear and laid down. Kelly had not taken her jar of lotion when she left. Robert opened it, inhaled her perfume, and rubbed it on. He fantasized about what he wished he had done to her. Kissed the back of her neck when he moved the strands of her hair. Massaged the lotion onto her soft skin, warm from the sun, her body awakening, reacting to his caresses. Nibble on her ear, then take her hands that were holding her bikini top to her chest and pull them away. Then massage the lotion onto her soft breasts and firm body. Her breathing quickens from his fondling, her nipples harden. His left arm presses against her breasts, pulling her tight to him. She moves her hips on him. His right hand coolly picks a gob of lotion from the jar and smears it down her stomach, mixing it with the wet of her perspiration. His fingers stretch out and push under her bikini bottom. She sighs and rises on her tiptoes to meet them. Robert's phone rang. He jumped. It was Kelly, on FaceTime. Oh, crap. How to explain this? Robert didn't move while the phone rang and waited until it stopped, then took a breath. His face was flushed. He was still holding his erection when the phone rang again. She's not going to stop, is she? He had wanted to see her again, talk to her, hell, have anything to do with her. Okay. Okay. She can only see my face. He answered the phone. Kelly's voice was soft, like she was just awakening from a sweet dream. Hi, were you thinking of me?
Yes.
Were you masturbating?
Kelly.
Don't lie to me. You promised to always tell me the truth. Warmly, are you pleasuring yourself?
Kelly.
Robert.
Yes.
Good. I'm glad you're thinking of me while you're masturbating. Let me watch. Turn your phone around so I can see.
Kelly, really what?
Come on, let me see. Teasingly, commande commande.
Kelly.
Purring, please.
Oh, hell.
Robert turned the phone and propped it with his pillow.
Kelly giggled.
Don't let me stop you. Robert lay his head on the pillow, careful so as to not disturb the phone, and returned to what he had been doing. Kelly's voice whispered through the phone. I liked what you did to me today.
I liked that too.
I came so hard.
I just put lotion on your back.
Is that what you were thinking when I called?
Robert nuzzled the phone.
No. Were you thinking of what happened between us today?
Robert nodded.
You were so shy.
I had to prompt you.
Put some on my front.
You did, on my chest, being so careful not to touch my breasts.
I took off my top.
All of me, I said and closed my eyes.
And you did.
Lower.
You moved your hand down and brushed along the top of my bikini bottom.
Lower, I whispered.
You shot fire through me. It's a good thing you held your arm around me while I was climaxing, or I would have collapsed on the floor.
Robert's hand was pumping up and down on his cock, moving faster, as was his breathing.
Kelly's bedroom voice was whispering through the phone next to his ear. His legs pressed against the mattress. His hips lifted. His free hand clutched the bed sheet, stretching it toward him. Her fantasy was working for him as well as his had.
Would you like to come?
Robert groaned. Close your eyes and let me help you out with that.
My hands are on you now.
Can you feel me?
Robert's head lifted off the pillow, his face scrunched.
You feel so strong.
His stomach muscles tightened as hard as a drum.
I'm not going to stop.
Robert's legs stiffened.
I want you to come.
Are you going to come?
Robert grunted through clenched teeth.
You can pretend I'm a boy if you want to. His head jerked back against his pillow. The phone bounced onto the bed. Kelly giggled as Robert climaxed, "Bye, Robert," and she hung up. Chapter 3. The Perch. In the mansion, next to Kelly's bedroom, was another windowless room, not much more than a large-sized closet, which held electronic, computer, and sophisticated surveillance equipment. The owner of the mansion, Sam Gallo, wanted a hub from where he could supervise and control his various properties and assets. Sam wanted his hub to have the best money could buy. He was assured that's what he got. Sam wanted the surveillance part of the system to be first class. I don't want a son of a bitch mouse to move without my knowing it. And so it was done. Kelly never learned if the company that did the installation was afraid Sam might see a mouse, or that the company was connected, and Sam was the mouse. In either event, Sam got so much more than he had bargained for. Sam didn't understand how intrusive the system was. He didn't know that cameras followed the housekeeper as she cooked and cleaned the mansion, Elaine, his wife, as she drank and dressed for a party she would never go to, himself, as he fumed and boiled over documents and accounts in his office. He didn't know that microphones listened as he issued instructions to visitors to the mansion, and commands through his phone system. Sam didn't know that there was no communication he had, with associates, politicians, bankers, or concubines, made in person, by phone, or internet that was not recorded, analyzed, and remembered. But Kelly did. Sam's vision when he had the equipment installed was to sit in this room, the perch, he called it, and leisurely push buttons from which he could do his banking and investments, supervise and control his properties and businesses, and swoop down on an errant associate or employee with a phone call, or text message. That was Sam's dream. He tried it. He didn't like it. Sam was a hands-on kind of guy. He preferred to do his swooping in person, to summon associates, politicians, bankers, and concubines to genuflect before his desk in his office. Besides, there were two things wrong with the room. There was only one door to get in or out. Sam never went anywhere where there was not another way out. Also, his back was to the door when sitting at the computer table. Sam never sat anywhere with his back to a door. After he tried his perch, Sam never went back. But Kelly did. From her perch, Kelly studied Sam's businesses and learned. One of Sam's busiest businesses, Gallo's Galleria, Sam renamed it after he purchased it, the largest porn store in the Midwest, is what the advertisement said. The shop, is what the employees called it in polite company and wanted to be subtle. Gallo's sex store is how everyone thought of it, and there was nothing subtle about that. But it was much more than a shop. Located in a renovated three-story warehouse on the north, central edge of Chicago, there were rooms where live models catered to requests from clients, and studios for photographing and creating pornographic books, magazines, and posters. There were production and printing facilities for the distribution of the porn. It had a fully equipped sound stage that would make even Hollywood blush, for the production of innovative pornographic videos that would have also caused Hollywood to blush. Other businesses Sam owned were in construction and trash. Kelly thought this one the most interesting. Kelly had discovered the perch the day she and her mother moved in with Sam. Ignored all but occasionally by Sam, and all the time by her mother, she spent more time in this room than in her own. Alone during the days and nights in the room, the only light on her face from the monitors, she entered the virtual world of the machine, melded with it, and became one with it, and let no one man put asunder. It came naturally for Kelly. A savant, it would have been said, if anyone had been watching. At first, it was computer games. She was soon beating all the boys. That became tiresome. She turned to programming, creating her own games. Where did the code come from? It flew through her fingers onto the keyboard. No one could beat those games, not even her. Kelly never went to college, almost didn't make it through middle school. It was all so boring. She got such poor grades she was told she might have to repeat 7th grade. She learned to crack the school's computer system. Then Kelly started getting A's. Hacking into other systems she found was what she liked best. It was more fun than beating the boys at their games. Here she beat big boys in real time. If such designations were given in hacker school, she would be a black belt. It wasn't malicious, and she didn't cause damage. It was just fun. Well, except for the bank where Sam kept some deposits. Here she got a little spending money, a little spending money here, a little spending money there. For now, she didn't take much, minimal, unnoticed, untraceable. One day her little code was blocked from making a small withdrawal. At first, she thought the bank may have caught her. Then she examined the bank's system. Someone else's code had latched onto the amount before hers. It took her 2 days to trace the source of that code. It belonged to Thaddeus Reminsky Tinkerton. Brains, for short, at least that's what everyone in his computer user group called him. Lawyers' families don't have wills, doctors' families don't get regular checkups, plumbers have leaky houses. Hackers don't protect their systems from being hacked. At least that was true of Brains. Chalk it up to arrogance, perhaps. In any event, Kelly found Brains' backdoor and penetrated him. She learned Brains was living in his parents' basement in the small Wisconsin town near the cottage. That was curious. She pulled up pictures of him. How interesting is that? She remembered him. She examined his code in the bank. For now, it was like hers, removing small amounts from accounts as a test of the waters. But when let loose, it was poised to empty every account in the bank in a millisecond and sail away with Brains to a tropical island. That would not do at all. Kelly left an artifact in the bank's system. Small enough that an arrogant brain should not notice, but a beacon bright enough to alert the authorities. Then she deleted her code so no one could follow her. Well? That was a close call. Kelly wasn't interested in protecting the bank, nor the few accounts Sam kept there. She had another reason, a plan that Brain's scheme could have ruined if he had acted first. It was a wonderful plan. A plan not even an interfering god could prevent. A plan spent many years in the making. She was going to take everything Sam had. She was going to take his life. Brain's scheme was a warning. She had stopped him, but there could be others out there about to pounce. It was time to implement the plan. But to find the right person. An artist who was young and pliable, poor and pliable, no family, and pliable. She searched through the internet. She was not having much luck. It was a gift from the gods, she felt. Or, perhaps just an accident, when her third bestest friend, Ariana, quit college and came back home. The two spent hours together, with the crying Ariana telling Kelly about her boyfriend, Bob, who had jilted her. They were going to get married, Ariana had thought. Kelly followed Bob through his Midwest travels, gasoline charges, motel receipts, ATM records where he would pull cash from his dwindling bank account. It was a twisted path that ended in North Platte, Nebraska. She needed him in Chicago. She sent her second bestest friend, Sydney, to fetch him. Then she paid a Chicago arts magazine to write a story about Bob. She felt she paid too much to get them to print it, but then again, Bob was not a very good artist. Once she had him in Chicago, there was the matter of getting him to the carriage house. The article in the magazine and Bob's picture she showed her mother sufficed to get the invitation sent. Bob would be the fourth artist in residence. Though each artist was unique in their own way, they all had three similar characteristics: young, good-looking, and male. Funny, Sam never figured that one out. The first artist was when she was 10, just a couple of years after she and her mother had moved in with Sam. Her mother did not spend much time with that artist. But Kelly did. He offered her candy and small gifts to pose nude for him. Kelly would have done it for free. She thought it funny how nervous she could make him. Once, she had to suppress a giggle when he dropped and damaged his camera. The second was when she was 15. That artist was not nervous at all. No, he wasn't. He had her pose on the table by his easel. "You need to hold real still," he told her. He tied her to the post behind the table to help her do that. The third was only a couple of years ago. When Sam left for the day, her mother would go over to the carriage house, and Kelly would watch through the cameras from her perch. He sure taught her experienced mother some things. Oh yes, he did. And when Sam and her mother were both gone, Kelly went to the carriage house, and he taught Kelly some things as well.
Oh yes, he sure did. It was a wonderful plan. She and her very bestest friend, Janie, spent long sessions concocting it.
Well, really, she had to admit, it was Janie's plan.
You be the sexy one, and I'll be the smart one, Janie told her.
Kelly was okay with that.
They laughed, we'll make a great team, Janie said.
Sometimes, she was a little afraid of Janie. From her perch, Kelly watched Robert watch for her to come out to the pool. From her perch, she recorded Robert as he recorded her prancing and posing around the pool as if unaware of him.
From her perch, she observed Robert when, on his bed at night, he sought release from his frustrations.
Relieve yourself, Robert.
Relieve yourself all you want, she mused.
But you'll never be satisfied until I'm done with you.
From her perch, she studied Robert and learned.
Robert didn't know of these observations, of the plan he was now a part of the snare he was now in.
But Kelly did.
Chapter 4. Getting into deep water. She never touched him, that was the crazy part. Last night, she made him ejaculate all over himself and never even touched him. He had his phone cradled near his head while she instructed him, reach here, put your fingers there, now slow, now hard, she had prompted him, aroused him, brought him to the edge, then surprised him. She took control of him as no creature ever had. Creature is what came to his mind when he thought of her, a nimble, lithe creature of arms, strong legs, and long hair, an animal that would wrap itself around him and ravage him. The image excited him, and his penis twitched when he thought about it. But what Kelly had urged him to do also embarrassed him. Masturbation was something he did quite often, but it was a word he kept in the back of his head. You are not supposed to touch yourself down there, he was taught. It was dirty. And you're a dirty little boy. Yet Kelly made him do it. Can you imagine? While she watched. She was an amused conductor, making him play with his body like a musical instrument. He liked it and loathed it.
And what did she say?
Her voice, a soft whisper, you can pretend I'm a boy if you want to.
Had she really said that?
Is that what sent him over the edge?
Robert didn't believe so, he was pretty sure about that.
Kelly had come out to sunbathe around 11 o'clock on other days. It was now 9:30, Robert was waiting at the window, but this time, not to take pictures.
How to do this?
She'll come out, throw her towel on my spot, stretch, she always does that, then she'll use some of her lotion, for sure. I should go out then and offer to help her put it on.
He smiled.
After the lotion, she'll lay the towel on the patio and stretch out on it. That could be a good time. Wait till she's laying down, then, hi, can I join you? And lay down beside her.
No. That might scare her.
Maybe I should go out there now and pretend I'm reading or something.
Yeah, but what if she sees me and decides not to come out?
Robert was still debating with himself when Kelly came out at 11:30. She was wearing her white bikini, Robert's favorite. Robert went to the door. His hand stayed suspended above the handle while he watched Kelly stretch, put on her lotion, and lay down.
Shit, it's too late. I missed my chance.
Maybe wait till tomorrow.
No.
This has got to happen. Robert opened the door, then looked down.
Shit.
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 Should have thought of it before. He shut the door and ran back to his bedroom. Robert didn't own a swimsuit, so he took his clothes off and put on some cutoffs. Kelly was lying on her back as Robert gingerly approached, wondering what he was going to say to her. Kelly turned and lifted on an elbow and looked at him.
Hi, want to join me?
Robert laid down next to her. Kelly picked up her jar with the lotion.
I was hoping you'd come out earlier and help me put this on.
Kelly shrugged.
But now I already have.
She put the jar down.
Oh well, maybe next time.
The voice reminded him of what a dummy he was.
I'm glad you came out to be with me, she said.
Yeah, me too.
Kelly looked hard at him.
Isn't this better than staring at me from your window?
Robert's face felt hot.
I'm sorry about all that. I guess I felt you being the owner's daughter and all, I wouldn't stand a chance.
So you hid and took pictures of me instead.
Robert hung his head. There was nothing he could think of to respond to that.
What's changed your mind about me?
Kelly asked.
Yesterday, getting to meet you.
That was nice.
Kelly smiled.
How about last night?
Robert's face was burning.
That was pretty.
Adventuresome?
Yes.
It was that.
Are you an adventuresome boy, Robert?
I like adventuresome boys.
Strings tied into bows were all that were keeping Kelly's swimsuit on.
Robert's hand reached out and fiddled with one of the strings on her bikini bottom.
Pull that string, and my panties will fall off, Kelly said, although she did nothing to stop him.
Still, Robert moved his hand away.
Kelly looked him over.
You need some lotion, you'll burn to a toast.
Lay back.
Robert did, and Kelly worked the lotion onto him, his arms first, then his chest, fingering it onto his nipples, then his stomach.
She slowed at the top of his pants.
Robert wondered if she'd see the bulge.
Then Kelly slid down, massaging his legs as she advanced, and even stroked the underside of his feet, making him flinch and Kelly giggle.
I'm going to cover every inch of you.
Kelly stretched back to lie next to him.
I got all of you except your face.
Kelly put lotion on Robert's cheek, he leaned over and kissed her.
Kelly snuggled into him.
Robert's arms wrapped around her.
Their bodies rolled together, sliding and slippery from the hot sun and the lotion, while their tongues invaded each other's mouths.
Robert's hand moved onto Kelly's bottom, kneading her bare skin.
He pulled her to him and pushed his hardness against her.
Miss Kelly, I fixed some lemonade for you.
Robert jerked away.
Kelly looked up.
Mary, I don't believe I asked for any.
No, Miss Kelly.
I thought it might be nice for you and your friend on such a hot day.
I'll just put it on the table over here for you where you can come and sit and enjoy it.
Robert watched Mary put a tray with glasses and a pitcher of lemonade on the table in the gazebo, then go back into the mansion.
We might as well have some, Kelly said.
Or she'll come back out to ask why not.
Who's that?
Kelly bounced up and stepped to the table.
Our housekeeper, Mary, she's taken care of me ever since I've lived here.
Robert was slower to get up.
When Kelly glanced away, he adjusted his pants.
Was she watching us?
Probably, she can see us from the kitchen window.
She's always been protective of me.
You worry her.
Kelly struck a coquettish pose.
You know, older man, more experienced, taking advantage.
Kelly sat down.
Come on, join me, and have some.
They sat next to each other and sipped lemonade.
There was a long, anticipative lag in their conversation.
Kelly looked at Robert and smiled.
Robert leaned over, put his hand on the back of Kelly's head, and pulled her to him.
Their mouths and tongues started up where they had left off before being interrupted by the housekeeper.
Robert's hand moved to Kelly's breasts.
Miss Kelly.
Mary was standing next to the gazebo.
I wanted to remind you of your hair appointment for this afternoon.
Kelly pulled away from Robert.
She was not pleased.
That's not until tomorrow, Mary.
Oh.
Yes, sorry, Miss Kelly.
I got that mixed up.
Mary went back into the house.
Kelly let out a sigh.
I guess she's going to keep up with this.
Kelly got up.
Let's go for a swim.
She won't be able to see us in the water.
Kelly stood at the edge of the pool.
Robert had not gotten up.
Kelly turned, come on, this is the deep end.
All she'll be able to see are the top of our heads.
Robert slowly got up, eased toward the pool, and stood behind Kelly.
How deep is it?
Oh, plenty deep.
Way over our heads.
Robert could see the other end of the pool, the lighter blue color marking the shallow water, becoming a darker blue as it got closer to him.
Robert kept his right foot back.
He put his left foot near the edge of the pool and peered over the side.
It was all moving crazy, twisting, turning, a kaleidoscope of light, and deep, impossibly deep.
He felt his head swimming down near the bottom and stepped back.
Kelly looked at him.
What's the matter?
I'm just not real big on swimming.
What are you talking about?
Everyone can swim.
I didn't say I couldn't. I just don't like it.
So, what's the big deal? Robert considered that an interesting story from his childhood. It had even earned him some sympathy points with Ariana. I don't really remember the details. It was something my parents argued about, one of the many things. What I remember is mostly what my father told me later when I was in grade school, and he was trying to teach me to swim. I suppose to help me get over my fear of water, obviously, it didn't work. It happened when I was about 2 or 3. Anyway, my parents were still together, so I wasn't 5 yet. They had gone to a friend's cabin on a lake. There was a pier that jutted out into the lake from the shore. The end of it was in deeper water so people could dive or moor their boats. My father stayed on shore while my mother and some other women walked out to the end of the pier and got in the water to swim. She brought me out with her. I was in a small, plastic inner tube. Robert held out his arms to show the size of it. Like you would buy at a toy store. Kelly put her hand on Robert's back, a wicked smile grew on her face. Robert pretended not to notice but took a step back anyway. My father says he wasn't paying much attention. He knows he heard my mother screaming, "My baby! My baby!" When he looked, he saw that a breeze had blown my inner tube away from the women. It was bobbing on the surface of the lake, and it was empty. I remember being on the bottom of that lake. It was a dirty gray. I couldn't see more than a couple of feet. I hadn't tried to take a breath yet. Babies naturally hold their breath. But there was something there, something malignant, waiting for me. I could see its face, I had seen it before. It hid under my bed at night. I opened my mouth to cry. Kelly crossed her arms. "Well, you don't need to be a crybaby about it now. Don't you want to hear the rest of what happened?"
"Not really, Robert. It's a yawner. History. You made it, didn't you?"
"Barely." Kelly pushed harder on Robert's back, causing him to take another step back from the pool. "It's not that big a deal. Watch." Kelly jumped into the pool, splashing water on Robert. When she came up, she looked at him. "Come on in. The water won't hurt you." Robert stepped to the edge of the pool and stood to look down. Kelly flung more water at him. "The water won't hurt you, but I might if you don't get in here."
"I don't think I can do it."
"Oh, I think you can." Kelly reached behind her and pulled off her bikini top and pushed it toward Robert. It spread out on the surface. "Come in, Robert, I have plans for your hands that the housekeeper doesn't need to see." Robert watched the bikini top sink. He followed it down, his head swimming. He stepped back from the edge.
"I can't."
"Robert, we're talking about the most adventuresome sex you've ever had. Now get in here right now." Robert stood back, his arms across his chest, his head down, shaking. Kelly scoffed. "You really need to man up." She bobbed down and reached for her bikini top and put it on. Then she got out of the pool, brushed past Robert, and picked up her towel. She turned and looked at him, "If you want to play with me, pal, you better get used to deep water." Then she marched off to the mansion. Chapter 5. It's my party. Robert called Kelly several times after the pool incident. She never answered. That didn't stop Robert from leaving various vague messages about getting together. Kelly eventually sent him a text message. "Why are you even breathing? You're taking up my oxygen." Robert stopped calling her after that. He stopped taking pictures as well. But he didn't stop thinking about her. Kelly came out to lounge at the pool several more times that early fall. Robert, hiding in the carriage house, was waiting for her, hating himself every moment he could not tear himself away from the window. He was better than this. He could remember that. The days were getting colder. At night there was a crispness in the air, and leaves were turning. There had been a time, not so many years ago, when there was college, friends, and football, girls in short skirts and tight sweaters. There had been Ariana. It had been better. He had been better. He left it to follow the whims of the wind, and it scattered him over the vast grasslands of the American Great Plains. There was no plan. Bob wasn't going to some place. He was escaping from this place, the town where he grew up,
his friends, Ariana? It was an impulsive, well-thought decision. He said no goodbyes to anyone except to her. That was as hard as he knew it would be. He steeled himself and broke her heart. Tears filled her eyes. His? No. He was on empty. The road helped. The hum of the tires on the pavement, the syncopated rhythm, the rocking of the Jeep, the miles and miles moving by him, the world in action passively passing by his windshield, numbed him, and the distance of everything behind him grew. Bob drifted mostly north the first months, heading into North Dakota about the same time winter was heading south. They bumped into each other in a small prairie town, where he was snowed in for a couple of days. He thought this might be a good place to spend the winter. At a cafe, he met a rancher willing to rent him a small cabin out of town. "But you're crazy to try it." It was on a dirt road 20 miles out into the Badlands, then past a gate and up a steep trail for another couple of miles. Sheep herders used it in the summers but abandoned it to the winter. It had no running water, no electricity, no heat except for a kerosene stove used for cooking, and cell phones did not work. You'd be all alone out there. He took it. Once winter got serious, he was told, not even his Jeep, assuming it would start, could make it down the trail to the gate and the dirt road. The rancher agreed to bring him supplies every couple of weeks, or so, and leave them by the gate. Bob would have to hike down the trail and carry the supplies back to the cabin. He would leave a note and money for the supplies he needed for the next delivery. The rancher was good to his word, and through the winter, every couple of weeks, or so, the supplies Bob requested were waiting for him at the gate. The temperature that year dropped to minus 15 degrees. Arcs of the aurora borealis twisted and swayed over his head at night, and sun dogs flamed in the morning sky. Ice crystals floated in the air by day, surrounding him with a million brilliant pinpricks of light. The ground was covered with snow, except for stretches where the wind had torn it away. He hiked over the hills, bundled against the cold. At first, he would only go short distances from the hut, tentative. But through the weeks, he became more confident and ventured further out into the hills. The Great Plains is a misnomer, he thought, if one thinks of a billiard table, that is. It's not flat, well, except for parts of Kansas, but certainly not here. From the high ridges, he watched the land rising and falling like giant frozen ocean waves heading forever toward a boundless horizon. Lower, in the valleys and gullies, windblown rock and snow surrounded him, and the cloudless blue sky spread over the ridges above his head. It was a stark environment. Nothing moved on it but him. It was serene, noble, and raw. It tested, stripped, and purified. He let himself get lost in the vastness of it all, and the loneliness, and of how small he was. He would stay out until the cold penetrated his coat, then retrace his footsteps in the snow to find his way back to the hut. At night, while the wind rattled the door, he would huddle by the small kerosene stove to stay warm. He was as an ascetic monk, living simply and alone. For something to do, he tried sketching and drawing on a small writing tablet. There were no windows in the cabin, so even in the daytime, he needed to use the kerosene lantern for light. He moved the only table to near the stove and put the lantern on that. He had taken his first, and only art classes his senior year at college, and there paid more attention to Ariana than to his studies, so his drawings were rough. But he kept at it. He became immersed. His requests to the rancher started including drawing pads and pencils, which the rancher brought every couple of weeks, or so. He tried oil painting for a time but first had to thaw out the oils before using them. One time, as a gift, the rancher left a book on how to draw. "My guardian angel," Bob called him and laughed. He drew his cabin, and the hills, and the places and people he knew. He thought he became quite good. Bob drew a sketch of the rancher. He did not draw Ariana. As the winter wore on, Bob became obsessed with his art. Day or night were not much different in the windowless cabin, and he would sit for unknown hours by the stove, a blanket wrapped around him, trying to get a sketch just perfect. "This is so crazy. Why can't I get it right? Draw a line here, no. That's wrong. Erase, over there." He would seize the lantern on the table and hold it closer to the drawing so he could examine it better. The wind pounded at his door, "Let me in. Let me in. Let me see what you're doing."
"No. Go away," he would shout back. He would get angry at a drawing, wad it up, throw it into the stove and watch it burn.
"At least you're good for something." Sketches that he didn't burn were crumpled and scattered about the cabin. Sometimes, he forgot to eat. He stopped going to the gate for supplies. Sometimes, he forgot to sleep. Then the storm came, heavy spring snow, and the wind, a terrible thing, shrieking and wailing into the night. Bob had not heard a human voice for over 3 months, now he heard someone outside calling his name. He ran out the door. He never understood what happened that night, out there in the hills. Never told anyone about it. They would think I'm crazy. The wind grabbed him when he went out the door, pushed him away from the cabin, and sent him floundering through snowdrifts, tripping over covered rocks, falling down in hidden holes, desperately chasing the voice. He stumbled on until he was out of breath and worn out, his clothing soaked inside from sweat, outside from wet snow. He started shivering. He was so far out. He had never been here before. There was nothing he recognized. He didn't know where he was, and so intensely thirsty, he started eating handfuls of snow. His stomach turned and threw it back up. He tried again. The icy water burned down his throat and stomach. His soaked clothing froze to him. There was nothing warm left in his world. He started shaking uncontrollably. "Save yourself if you can," the wind screeched. He ran. The storm battered him, the wind hissed with delight in his ears. He needed home but had lost his way. Then he saw his footprints. Thank God. They would take him back to the hut. He pursued the prints. But the wind tore ahead and erased them, then turned on him. "Now, I have you." He stopped and let out a last desperate cry. The wind was exultant. "Yield to me." His legs could not hold him. He started to collapse. Snow and ice shot up from the ground and tore around him. The wind was shrieking in jubilation. He sank into the blinding chaos from which he would never rise. "Hi. You look lost." He looked up, it was Ariana. She turned and disappeared into the storm. He chased after her, wallowing through the snowdrifts. The wind whipped him and flayed his cheeks and rose up a terrible angry shrilling. Then his hut was in front of him, the door still open from when he had run out. He stumbled inside and fell down. "All you have to do is say you're sorry," he heard. He turned to respond, but no one was there. He dropped his head, huddled on the floor, and cried. That's how the rancher found him. "I got worried about you after you didn't get your supplies the last few weeks, or so. People can go crazy and die up here." He gave Bob a wary smile. "Usually in that order." He picked Bob up and sat him in the chair by the stove. "I can see you didn't die." He looked about the cabin, the disheveled sketches scattered about. Not so sure about the other part. The rancher started a fire in the stove and warmed the cabin. I had to wait for the storm to be over, and some of it to melt. Then it took me 2 days to plow a path up here. He fed Bob some food he had brought. "Son, this is crazy." Then he went about the cabin, picking up the strewn sketches. "Spring is here." He packed Bob's papers and belongings into a duffel bag. "Winter's over." Then handed Bob the keys to his Jeep. "It's time for you to go." He had had no ambition when he had moved into the cabin other than to escape, but the winter there transformed him. He had been enclosed in a cocoon, his but a small heartbeat, developing and changing in a frozen world. Bob emerged from his little hut to fulfill what he now felt was his destiny. As Christ left the wilderness a prophet and set off to save men's souls, he had found his purpose, so now did Bob. Throughout America's history, the Great Plains was a place people crossed over. America's great migration flowed over this place from east to west. But some paused and settled, and stuck to the land. It was this precipitate he now undertook to capture with his art and photography. There was Annie. She looked as old as the original homestead along the Missouri River that she lived on. She took him bouncing along a rutted road in her rusted go-to-bar car to a bluff overlooking the river. "Be careful stepping here," she told him. Archaeologists had discovered this spot was an ancient Indian burial place. They had wanted to come back to excavate the site.
"No," she told them, "let all of us rest in peace."
From the top of the bluff, they watched the flow and eddies of the Missouri River busily moving the Rocky Mountains to the Gulf of Mexico, just as it had been doing since the last ice age. He found Jake, walking along a deserted road in north-central Oklahoma, U.S. Marine Corps, 1st Battalion, 9th Marine Regiment, and damn proud of it. Jake was a wanderer too. Jake left Afghanistan in 2014. It had never left him. They traveled together for a few days until the wind swirled and blew them apart. He did paintings of Annie, and Jake, and Nikki, his Blackfoot princess, he called her, who showed him her tribe's secret places in northern Montana, and Shelley, who shooed rattlesnakes away from her yard with a broom so her kids could play, and Gus, who could be found after working at a garage all day, in his backyard fixing up cars. Bob tried to sell his paintings. "Never heard of you. Are you in some other galleries? If only you had something published. It's really not that good, son." Whenever someone called him son, he knew they were not going to buy. He signed each of his paintings with Bob and dated it with the year. In a few years, paintings with that signature would be held in high demand by collectors, and art dealers would scrounge for paintings with that little signature. But that was in his future. For now, he ended up disheartened and broken living in North Platte, Nebraska. It had been better. He had been better. He hated what he had become, and he was ashamed. The phone rang. It was Kelly. "I'm having a party tonight. Come over at 7. She hung up before Robert could respond. The windows in the mansion were open. Robert waited until he heard music playing and people talking. Occasionally a few of the guests came out onto the patio. They were younger than he, Kelly's age, her friends. He didn't want to go over, but he needed to see Kelly. Despite all evidence to the contrary, he was sure if he could only talk to her, they could get back together. She had called and invited him, after all. That must be what she wanted as well. He could be adventurous. He was sure of it. Robert crossed the patio and entered the mansion. He had never been in here. He could very much use a drink. The bar was on the other side of the room. He saw Kelly was there with some guy leaning against it. He decided to wait for the guy to leave before talking with Kelly. It was a typical party, with small groups milling about. Robert could see these people didn't need an excuse for a party, any or none would do. He learned that the purported purpose of this party was for Kelly's boyfriend who was going back to college. Robert was chagrined to learn Kelly had a boyfriend, pleased that the boyfriend was about to depart. He stood unnoticed on the outside of a few of the groups. The room was full of adolescent babble. The boys competing for who had gotten the drunkest or most stoned at the last party. The girls comparing to see who shopped at the most exclusive clothing store. The winner was a girl who was planning her wedding and just returned from shopping at Vera Wang in New York. The most exotic summer vacation was also up for discussion. French Polynesia and St. Barts were in the running for the yachting crowd. Someone mentioned Aspen, but everyone's been there.
"Yeah, but we had dinner with Rihanna.
Who spent the most, for the best," was the topic of the various groups. No one discussed who was paying for their extravagances. Parents were never mentioned. They were younger than him, separate from him, but the divide was not generational. It was wealth, it was class. "Who's your family? What school did you go to? What do you do?" "No one. Nowhere. Not much." Perhaps he could have tried a little harder. He had gone to a small college, and even there had been a long way from being the big man on campus. It was a small pond, and he was just a tiny fish. But at least there he had some friends, and there he had belonged. Here he was left flopping about, sucking for air at the feet of these haughty, uncaring children. He thought them a ridiculous group. They had done nothing more with their lives than pick a wealthy family to be born to. Yet, having done only that, they thought entitled to the adoration of everyone else. A pretentious bunch indeed. He had been inching over toward Kelly. He saw she had glanced his way when he first walked in but did nothing to greet him, watching his clumsy attempts to fit in. The guy was still there, his left arm locked around Kelly, his right hand around a drink. Robert figured this must be the boyfriend. He put out his hand.
"Hi, I'm Robert."
The guy did not put out his hand, keeping it around his drink. He did point his index finger at Robert, "Travis." Then Travis turned his back to Robert, leaned down, and with the drink still in his right hand, began making out with Kelly. Robert watched Travis's back. He was the most pompous of the pretentious lot of them. The most arrogant of the undeserving wealthy, the most foolish of that ignorant class. The most, but he had Kelly. "He's a jerk." Robert's face felt hot. How many in the party had seen him dismissed so contemptuously? Every head was looking at him. Every laugh at his expense. He turned and pushed through the groups toward the patio door. That's when he saw her. There was a brief ache in his heart. She didn't appear to have seen him. Thank God. He didn't need any more rejection. He slipped out without talking to her. Robert's mind was flying too fast to be trapped inside the carriage house. He needed space, and went to his spot in the gazebo, sat, and watched the lights in the mansion, listened to the music, and the chattering guests. He stayed in the gazebo until the music and talking stopped, the guests all left, the lights turned off, and he was left in the dark. What was that all about? Why was I even invited? And why was she there? Sydney. God, Sydney Stewart. Chapter 6. It's My Kind of Town. Scene 1. The coffee shop. Robert remained in the gazebo and watched a gray dawn reach across Lake Michigan. 4 months earlier than this October morning, and 800 miles from this spot, his soul search had stumbled. His paintings were not selling, and he was out of money. He needed to survive. He took a job in North Platte, Nebraska, working as a photographer for a small newspaper. Working as a photographer for a small newspaper in a small town barely earned him enough to buy food and a place to sleep. Wasn't he meant for more than this? He wondered what he needed to do to catch a break. Then one day, on his way to the newspaper office, his phone rang. "Hello, I'm Sydney Stewart. I work for an arts magazine in Chicago. My editor has asked that I do a story on you. Interested?" Someone had heard of him? And in Chicago? Interested? Yes. They arranged to meet. Curious? For sure. Bob wondered which of his paintings had done it, had caught someone's attention. He would have to remember to ask Sydney when he met her. It shouldn't be hard to figure out. Only 3 had sold, and a half dozen more languished in a couple of craft supply stores. He devoted the next days to collecting his work and organizing it into his portfolio case. Then going through it, reorganizing, adding, taking away, then organizing again. Would they want to feature some of his paintings in the article? Was this the big break, the one every artist needs? Now, he was on his way. Nervous? You bet. Sydney came out to North Platte the next week. Bob had suggested a coffee shop where they could meet. He took some time to throw a few more paintings into his portfolio before leaving his room. Sydney was there when he arrived. "Hi," she said. "I wasn't sure how long it would take me to get here from my motel room." "It didn't take long." "No, nothing takes very long in North Platte." She was pretty, friendly, and wore a short skirt. She had Bob's attention. "Here's a table where we can sit. I brought my portfolio." Bob started to spread out his work. "Oh, don't bother. I don't need to see any of that. Let's just talk." A waitress brought them each a glass of water and said she'd be right back to take their order. Bob shoved his paintings into his portfolio and pushed it under the table. "I'm a little nervous. I've never been interviewed before." Sydney reached for her glass and knocked it over, spilling water on Bob. "Oops. Sorry. I guess that makes 2 of us that are nervous. I've never interviewed anyone before. I just started with this magazine." Bob pulled some paper napkins out of the napkin dispenser. "No problem. I'll clean it up." "So, why did you pick me?"
"I didn't.
You were turned over as an assignment."
"My first."
Sydney took out a recorder from her purse. "So, I'm supposed to ask you questions. Do you mind if I record this? If I have to write everything down, I'll get lost.
Sure, that's okay.
Why not?
Sydney looked serious.
I want to learn all about you, on and off the record, for background, she giggled.
Whatever that all means.
Bob was becoming less nervous. Sydney was wearing a pleasant perfume.
Go for it.
It was more like a first date, except Sydney was asking all the questions, and Bob was doing all the talking. She seemed interested in him. It had been a long time since he had opened himself up like this. In fact, not since Ariana. In fact, maybe never.
Sydney made it easy.
Well, so how did you decide to be an artist?
It wasn't my first choice.
There's a small liberal arts college in the town where I grew up. We couldn't afford for me to go away to school. So, after I graduated high school, I lived at home and went there. I started off with a science major but later switched to art. I worked a job at night to help pay the tuition.
Were your parents able to help you with that?
It was just my dad and me. My mother left us when I was a kid. My dad stuck it out, but her going was really hard on him.
Oh, tell me more about that.
Can we skip that for now?
Sure.
So how did you end up studying art?
Bob smiled.
Truthfully?
Yes, we're all about truth here, Bob.
Well, there was this girl.
Sydney twirled her hair with her fingers and giggled.
Isn't there always?
She was taking art.
What was her name?
Ariana?
Oh, that's a pretty name.
Pure.
Holy.
That's what Ariana means, pure, or holy.
I didn't know that, but the name fits.
Tell me about her.
Bob took a drink of water to stall for time. He wasn't sure how to talk about Ariana. He was sorry he had brought her up.
She was from Chicago, like you, and was in high school there and then came out to college.
She was studying performing arts.
I wasn't in art to begin with.
I wanted to be a scientist, an astronomer.
To study the stars?
Yeah, ever since I was a little kid. I thought anyone can do it.
You just need to look up.
Sydney laughed.
So, you had your head in the stars.
The concepts are mind-boggling.
That's what I liked about it.
At times it's metaphysical rather than science.
It's where science approaches poetry.
Oh yeah, like what?
Bob turned toward Sydney and put his arm on the back of his chair.
Well, for instance, have you ever heard of the Kelvin scale?
Sydney shook her head.
Not a clue.
The Kelvin scale measures temperatures.
It starts at absolute zero.
It's the coldest it's possible to get.
All motion ceases when it reaches that point.
You can remember it by thinking, okay.
0K, 0K, but it's not okay because everything is frozen.
So far, nothing's reached 0K.
Even in deepest space.
Sometimes it's called the null point.
I got in a discussion with my professor that wasn't correct.
Null is not zero.
It's nothing.
Sydney scrunched her face.
Zero is nothing.
No.
That's what I tried to tell him.
Zero is zero.
Null is nothing. He turned his back and started writing on the blackboard, muttering something unintelligible under his breath. But after class, one of the smart kids came up to me and said it might be correct to equate 0K with null, since if the universe ever reached 0K, there would be no energy left, and there would be no coming back from that.
We would all be null.
Sydney turned toward Bob.
That's so cute when you talk that way.
She giggled.
Do you talk to all the girls like that?
Sorry, that's about all I know about that anyway.
Bob smiled.
I didn't do very well in that class.
So, you were taking science classes, then you changed to art.
Bob shrugged.
I thought it would be easy.
Sydney touched Bob's shoulder.
And that's when you met Ariana?
Bob wasn't happy they were back to Ariana and kept it brief.
I took an art class she was in.
We saw more of each other, started dating.
It was my senior year.
She was a sophomore.
For some reason, he added, we were talking about getting engaged.
Bob took his arm off the back of his chair, turned to the table, and picked up his glass of water.
That's all. Sydney didn't pursue the Ariana subject.
So, why did you give up on your dream, to play around in the stars?
This was safe ground again. Playing would have been good.
But that's not how science works.
I wasn't cut out for it. I took a calculus class, for instance.
Calculus?
Yeah, that's a long way from playing.
Tell me about it.
After the final exam, the professor called me into his office. He said I deserved an F. He hadn't seen anyone do so poorly in his class. He told me if I swore I'd never take another class from him, he'd give me a D. I told him he had a deal.
Sydney giggled.
Bob's arm moved back to the back of his chair. So I went with art. Which is kind of funny, too. Some of the classes were painting nudes. We had co-eds as models. You can imagine those were popular classes.
I can imagine.
Guys who weren't even art students took those.
Yeah, I got it.
They weren't popular with me, though. I was nervous the whole time. I'm a disaster around pretty girls.
So you don't think I'm pretty?
You're doing pretty good with me.
Bob blushed.
No, you're really cute.
Sydney got up, moved to a couch, and patted the cushion for Bob to sit next to her.
I don't see why you would have problems with girls.
You're good looking, smart, a great artist, easy to talk with.
Bob joined Sydney on the couch and leaned toward her.
So, you think I'm good looking?
Sydney smiled back.
You're kind of cute too.
A pretty girl can get me to do about anything she wants with just a smile.
Sydney looked down at her feet and slipped her shoes off, then grasped an ankle, pulled her legs up, and tucked them under her.
The hem of her short skirt slipped further up her thighs.
Bob's eyes had followed Sydney's hand, then the hem as it climbed up her legs, which were bare and smooth, touchable smooth, as the commercials say.
Soft.
Bob's head jerked up.
Sydney was watching him.
A warm-faced Bob stumbled.
Sorry, I didn't mean to stare.
Sydney smiled.
I don't mind.
Bob tried to recover.
Do you have any more questions for me?
Sydney pressed against him.
Yes, but first, let's get the sex out of the way.
Scene 2.
The motel room.
Nothing is very far in North Platte. It did not take long to get to Sydney's motel room.
Bob went first.
He took Sydney's clothes off, kissing each part of her skin as he bared it. There was no part of her unkissed, no private place not touched, no secret space not probed. He spent the afternoon with his hands and mouth exploring her. He liked what that did to her, making her quiver and moan, bringing her to climax, exhausting her.
Then Sydney made it his turn.
Late that afternoon, after the playing and the sex, Sydney and Bob were dallying, neither in a hurry to leave their bed.
Sydney lay her hand on Bob's heart.
Tell me more about when you were growing up.
Haven't we already covered enough of that?
I want to know more about you.
You said your mom left you and your father.
Yeah, he had really loved her.
In the end, he had a lot of problems.
It killed him.
Did he drink himself to death?
No.
My father shot himself to death.
It surprised Bob how quickly that came out.
It was an image that was ever in the back of his head.
He tried to keep it there.
But sometimes the vision came forward and pulsed between his eyes.
I'm the one that found him.
Bob stared at his pillow, afraid to look at Sydney.
He wanted to see me graduate.
Bob played with Sydney's fingers that were on his chest.
He waited until the next day.
Both were quiet for a while.
Then Bob continued.
After the investigation, the police released the gun to me.
A pistol?
I've kept it.
Why keep it?
Doesn't having it make you feel worse?
Bob shrugged.
It's a remembrance.
I look at it sometimes.
Hold it.
I wonder what it was like, those last few moments before he did it.
He was home alone that day.
I was out just screwing around.
I try to recall what we talked about that morning, what I said when I left him, the last thing I would ever say to him.
I wonder if I had said something different, something more, something profound.
You feel responsible?
I feel like a ball full of shoulds and should-nots.
I don't think Catholics have a monopoly on guilt.
Guilt's the basis for all Christianity.
How'd you know I was?
Read up on you before coming out here.
I'm not a total neophyte.
My mother had left me, then my father. I had just graduated from college, my life beginning when it got yanked out from underneath me. I was bitter about my mother, I was furious with my father, and I was angry with God. I couldn't stay at that house anymore, so I took off and have been wandering ever since. My father left me a small inheritance, all he had. Enough to buy a used Jeep and to head out.
How far did that get you?
Bob chuckled.
North Platte.
So what about your girlfriend?
What about Ariana?
Bob fluffed up a pillow and lay his head on it. I told her I needed room to figure things out, what I was doing with my life. She asked if that included her. I told her I wasn't sure.
You are a shit, you know.
Yeah, I know. I've been thinking about that every day since I left.
You broke her heart.
Mine was broken too.
That's not good enough.
The bad things we do are never forgotten, we can only try to be forgiven, and you have to earn that.
I left the only person on this earth who cared for me, isn't that enough?
Sydney poked Bob's chest.
You left her.
And now I'm alone.
Sydney brushed her fingers over Bob's pillow a few times.
Sorry, I was overstepping. I guess I was remembering a boyfriend who dumped me.
Sydney kissed Bob's shoulder.
It's pretty painful. Everyone needs to have their heart broken once.
Knowing how it feels, maybe you're more careful next time.
More careful about getting into another relationship?
No.
More careful about how you do the dumping.
So has anyone ever dumped you?
No.
I stay loose.
Bob's throat caught at his betrayal of Ariana.
So, you're into the footloose, fancy-free life.
When you have nothing, do you have everything?
When you belong to no place, do you belong everywhere?
Bob smiled.
No, you're just homeless.
Sydney moved closer to Bob so their lips were almost touching.
Then come to Chicago.
You'd love Chicago.
She swung her head.
It's my kind of town.
I'm studying real people.
The working people of this country.
You're being awfully provincial.
People work in Chicago.
People in cities have souls too.
I was named after Sydney, Nebraska, where I grew up. When I moved to Chicago, I changed the spelling of my name.
That's not all that changed.
Sydney's not far from here, but it's a long way from Chicago.
I was a little girl in Sydney, but I'm a big girl in Chicago.
Come to Chicago and be a big boy.
I'll get you a job with my magazine.
I'm broke.
I may have enough for gas money to get there.
But I couldn't even afford a place to live.
Sydney whispered in Bob's ear.
Then stay with me.
A job at an arts magazine, that would really help his career, and a sexy girlfriend to live with to boot.
Bob quit his job the next week and drove to Chicago.
Sydney had given him her card.
It had a phone number, but no address.
He called her when he got to the city.
I'm sorry, my boyfriend just moved in with me.
He'd go crazy if I let you stay here.
Bob's heart sank.
Sydney had never mentioned a boyfriend.
Oh, okay.
I wonder if I can meet with your editor tomorrow.
I need to earn some money.
Really fast now, 'cause I've no place to live.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry about that too.
I got fired yesterday.
They thought I did a lousy interview with you.
My name is Mud around there.
Sydney, I don't know what to do.
I thought you and I might get together, after North Platte.
I'm sorry.
Robert remained in the gazebo until the sun broke the horizon over Lake Michigan.
That was a disaster.
All she gave me was a phone number for, let's face it, a porn dealer.
Robert sought other places to work at first, but opportunities vanished, and doors closed. He and his art ended up in the back of a porn shop.
Slept there too, the first month on the Inquisition rack, except when customers were examining it.
There were bedrooms and beds upstairs, but they were being used on a rotating basis, and he couldn't afford the hourly rent.
Robert smiled.
That was so much worse than my little hut in North Dakota.
Porn in the morning.
Porn in the evening.
Porn at supper time. Porn was all around him. Porn about any time. There were friends in college who would have thought he was living the life. There was a time he might have thought that as well. But the 24-hour-a-day porn was like a wet fish blanket. He had called the editor of the newspaper in North Platte to see about his old job. Forget it. He told the dealer he couldn't take living there any longer. He was leaving. Go ahead. But after working for us, you're not going to find anyone willing to hire you. And good luck living in your Jeep on a Chicago street. That's when he got the phone call. My client is a patron of the arts, and he's looking for someone to benefit, interested? Benefits included living in the carriage house, food, and an allowance. It was more than Robert could hope for. He jumped at the offer. It was explained only a little later, after he moved in, that he was expected to continue to work at the porn shop for his room and board, and his allowance would be a draw against any remaining earnings he might have. Now the trap had closed. Chapter 7. Falling out of and into love. Darwin started it. Some emotions are exhibited in the same way by people in all cultures. Gary Feigen followed up on that observation and described the details of the facial muscles used to create each of the emotions. That was helpful for artists. If their work captured one of these emotions, it could make a universal statement. It doesn't matter where in the world you are, people made the same face for a particular emotion. Even people blind since birth, who have never seen a human face, exhibit the same universal expressions. There are six of them: joy, surprise, fear, anger, disgust, and sadness. Joy, the beaming face is unmistakable across all cultures. Eyebrows relaxed. The eyes crescent-shaped, the mouth widened with corners pulled back toward the ears. Upper lip straight, showing upper teeth. Crow's feet and smile-shaped fold under eyes, dimples. A positive emotion, Robert thought. The second, surprise, could be seen as positive or negative. Positive, if the surprise led back to joy. Negative, if the surprise led to one of the other remaining emotions. After surprise, fear or anger, then disgust. Finally, sadness. The inner third of the eyebrows bent upward, or at least kinked, skin underneath piled up in a kidney-shaped knob. The eyes are slightly narrowed. Bags under eyes. Wrinkles are horizontal across the brow folds, middle of the forehead only. The human condition, of the six emotions we all share and exhibit, only one is positive. Robert wondered about adding another to the list, melancholy. Maybe after joy and before surprise. Pretty much, he felt, where every human being on the planet lived most of the time, before the fear, anger, disgust, and sadness of life inevitably overcame them. He knew how to draw the emotion of melancholy. He just had to look in a mirror. Robert was sitting at the table in the carriage house. He thought of Ariana. He had been happy then, that must have been true. At the college they went to, there was a euphemism that when someone whispered, he was in her room. Or, she was in his room. They were daintily saying, clothes were being removed, mouths were on breasts, genitals were being manipulated, and coitus was taking place. So, there was no question that the Times Bob suggested that he come to Ariana's room, what he was asking for. And there was no question of what she was saying each time Ariana said no. There is a time in a relationship when it either progresses or becomes stale and ends. The evening of October 28th was that time for Bob and Ariana. And they both knew it. They were at the bandstand. The evening was turning chilly, and Ariana's bare legs were cold. It was time to end the night. He kissed Ariana and whispered in her ear, "Let's go to your room." Ariana hesitated, then said, "No, I can't." Then there was the long, silent walk back to the dorm. There was no embrace, no kiss, no good night, only a glance from Ariana as she climbed the stairs to the entrance of the building. She turned at the top. They stood looking at each other, each with their hands buried deep in their jackets. Ariana took her right hand out and held it toward him, palm side up. "Will I see you tomorrow?" Her voice higher pitched than normal. His response, a low growl between teeth, his eyes narrowed, his brows contracted. "Sure." His hands stayed in his jacket.
Ariana tilted her head, stared at him for a moment, then swung around and went into her dorm. He entered her dorm room. Ariana's eyes widened.
"What are you doing here?"
Bob didn't answer. Instead, he closed and locked the door behind him. Then Ariana knew why he was there, and a shiver ran through her.
"Would you leave if I asked you to?"
"Yes."
He paused.
"Do you want me to leave?"
"No."
"Do you want me to stay?" Her voice was trembling.
"Yes.
Tell me you want me to stay." Ariana stepped up to Bob, took off his jacket, and tossed it into a corner of her room.
"Yes."
Then she placed her arms around his neck and kissed his cheeks while he unbuttoned her blouse. Bob's fingers fumbled, and she stepped back to finish for him. Ariana blushed. She was not wearing any clothing under her blouse. She had not been this naked in front of a man since she was a baby, and her father had changed her diapers. Not he, nor her brothers, had seen her like this since. She was embarrassed and pressed against him. He slipped off her blouse. They kissed, their tongues exploring each other as he undid her shorts. She pushed them down and let them drop to the floor. He pulled her to him. Her breasts pressed against his chest. His hands traveled down her back. Then he kneeled in front of her, grasped her panties, and uncovered her. They both were nervous that first time, unsure, they hurried it. They were clumsy. Through the next weeks, they got better.
"Tell me where you want me to touch you."
"I think you already found the place."
"No, not sexual parts, I want to explore the other parts of you. I want to know every secret place of you."
And they did.
"Now it's your turn."
"What would you like me to do?"
"Just tell me."
"Yes, there, please."
"Yes, like that."
"Oh yes, like that." Ariana liked Bob's fingers grazing over her mouth and cheeks. He loved her licking his eyelids, whispering unintelligible secrets in his ear, and kissing his neck. Ariana quivered, wiggled, and giggled as his fingers tickled down her arm, armpit, and side. Ariana's nipples were clearly sexual parts, so they were not included during Bob's turns. They agreed his nipples weren't sexual, so Ariana could lick and suck them when it was her turn. They both enjoyed brushing that place, just above their sex and below their belly buttons. Ariana's arm, "Oops, sorry about that," occasionally grazed his extended member. Bob would wrap his legs and an arm around Ariana's quivering body, while his other hand and fingers traced figure eights over her behind. Ariana moaned when he kissed the soft inside of her thighs. To hold her still, he laid on her legs while his tongue licked in and around and between her toes. In turn, Ariana lay on Bob's legs, while her fingers played butterfly over the bottoms of his involuntarily twitching feet. They delighted in discovering each other's secret places and bubbled over in happiness. The young couple played a game. "I'll do a place on you for 5 minutes, then you do me. We'll take turns." "Oh yes, there, thank you." They became flushed as the choices were made.
"Oh yes, like that, my love.
Oh yes." Feverish as the game continued. 5 minutes was too long. The turns grew shorter. Tongue flicked tongue, arms embraced, legs entwined. "Oh yes.
Oh yes." Mouth sucked breast, hand stroked cock, fingers caressed clit.
Oh. Their bodies burning, they played until their sexual parts embered and flamed.
"Oh my God, yes."
And joined in a euphoric firestorm of fused, furious, orgasmic delirium.
"Oh yes."
But that was 3 years ago. Now Robert spent his days in the city, photographing and painting models for pornographic stories. The central theme of all the stories being the damsel in distress, the eventually very naked damsel in distress, captured by monsters, human or otherwise. In the city, Robert performed his detested duties faithfully. But on his days off, and at night, he had Kelly, the photographs of her by the pool, at least. He took these to the back room of the carriage house and spread them out on the table and painted from them, producing the illustrations for the stories. Kelly didn't know it, but she became the virtuous damsel. The storytellers were content to leave their damsels in distress. It might make for a good sequel, but Robert was not with Kelly. He changed the images, thus changing the stories and causing rewrites.
Robert would paint himself in, a somewhat more muscular Robert, as a hero, rescuing the damsel, Kelly. He even started covering up her nakedness.
Robert painted what he saw in Kelly, felt about her, beautiful and passionate. Her left eye, a little narrower than her right. Not a blemish, an embellishment of perfection. Her mouth, a little deceitful, so it looked like she was forever smiling or making fun of him.
Robert didn't mind. She would make a little joke, and he would laugh. And oh, how she looked at him.
Robert glanced up from his painting.
Looked at me? Hell! I was spying on her the entire time. She never saw me.
His mind wandered, looking for her. From the patio, after she finished sunbathing, it followed her into the house where she sat down with her family for breakfast.
"Here, darling," she would say to him. "Have an English muffin with orange marmalade." He would reach over and pick a small crumb from the corner of her smiling mouth. Her parents looked on approvingly, for she had found such an excellent lover. After breakfast, they'd retire to Kelly's bedroom to continue their too short a night of lovemaking. There is Kelly, legs and hair, bare feet, her mouth open to him, her eyes taunting him, her breasts waiting for his caress.
"That bitch has you wrapped around her cunt. Go screw her, get her out of your system, and get back to work." That jarred Robert from his revelry. The writers were not enamored with Robert's new vision of Kelly, nor were the customers. Sales were down, and his dealer was not happy. The dealer's home run solution was not so simple for Robert, who rarely got to first base. Never good at picking up girls, he thought of himself as awkward and not very interesting, which made it true. Besides, he had tried. He had called Kelly numerous times with no response, except that painful one, and then later she made it crystal clear at the party, when she paraded Travis in front of him, that there was no chance for him. Making love, Robert couldn't consider words such as screw, bang, fuck, or anything so crude when it came to Kelly, wasn't going to happen. Unrequited love, Kelly, pure, perfect, Kelly, untouchable, and unattainable Kelly made her so much more captivating and desirable, so much more. He had worked to get along without emotions. They hadn't served him very well in the past, so now, when he tried to find the right one, he was out of practice. Robert was an observer of life, a requirement to be an artist, but not a doer, which meant he was not a particularly good one. His art had the world's details, but not its heart. He should call her. He knew that. Kelly's number was in his phone. He would look at it. "All I have to do is push the button and talk to her." But he couldn't push that button, not any more than he could pull the trigger on his gun last summer. Fall slipped into the holidays. There was no work for him at the porn shop for the holiday week, so Robert spent it alone. The gray of winter settled around him. He frittered away the time in the carriage house. Sometimes he looked out at the patio, the drained pool, the gazebo covered with snow. One day he was rummaging through the studio in the back of the carriage house. He found a portfolio case behind a couch. He brought it to the table and opened it. The contents were sketches, paintings, and photographs of a girl. A girl, 14, perhaps 15 years of age, and all the one same girl, Kelly. Kelly playful. Kelly contemplative. Kelly sensual and seductive. Kelly naked and as unbridled as the day she was born. An anonymous artist had done the work in this studio and not furtive as Robert, a voyeur taking Kelly's photos from afar. No. In these, the artist was next to her, standing where Robert now stood, Kelly naked on the table where Robert had spread out her photographs. The artist smoothing a strand of Kelly's hair, moving her hand to a different pose, touching her cheek to turn her head just so. "Now lick your lips." Breathing her in, feeling the fever of her. The unnamed, disliked artist touched what Robert could not. Robert worked with models in the studio in the city. There the models were all willing, at least they were paid, and would, occasionally it required coaxing, cajoling, and inveigling, perform as Robert directed. But nothing Robert had done captured the energy, the spirit, the vitality, the earthy awareness of herself that this artist had with Kelly. Robert got to the last image in the portfolio and sucked in his breath. It was a photo of Kelly, on the table with the post behind it, her hands chained above her head, as the unknown artist's hand brought her to orgasm. It was obscene, lustful, captivating. Robert couldn't turn away. He was jealous. Not that the nameless, hated artist was better than he, but with the realization, Robert was not the first. Kelly had had another lover. Robert kept the house cold. Not to save money. Hell, Gallo paid all the bills. No. He was as a monk, elevating abstinence to an austere art form. Denial, not from need, but to atone. He shivered as he wrapped in his blanket at night, the top pulled over his head so only his nose stuck out at one end, his feet at the other. Some adjustments around his shoulders so no cold air would creep in, the same in front, the blanket tight, confined as in a winding sheet, only his feet were cold. He'd push, curl, and scrunch. It didn't help. It would have been a simple fix, get another blanket. He didn't, and Robert continued to have cold feet. Isolated, lonely, the photographs no longer enough, he thought of the summer, of the spot, and of the gun hiding in his drawer. Perhaps it was time to finish it. He had dumped Ariana, and not in a very nice way. Now Kelly made it his turn. Kelly had been so available at first. If only I had gotten into that damn pool. Well, you're a wimp. What can I say? She wanted an adventurous boyfriend. I could be that. No. You're a loser. If only. You're a wimp loser. Even your mother left you. If only I could call her. If only I could get her out of my mind. If only I could be with her. Forget her. She's a lost cause. Kelly called.